Hello, and welcome to Benyo Chats. If you're curious about the world, this show is for you. Have you ever written a letter to Virginia Woolf? On this episode, I speak to Joanne Lindberg. Joanne is a prize-winning writer. Her latest book is Letters to My Weird Sisters on Autism, Feminism, and Motherhood. Hope you enjoy the show. Do like and subscribe as it helps others find the podcast. And with that, here's my chat with Joanne. Hey, everyone. I'm super excited to be speaking to Joanne Lindberg. Joanne has written poetry, novels, and memoir. Her latest book is Letters to My Weird Sisters on Autism, Feminism, and Motherhood. I highly recommend the book. On reading your work, I've learned a lot in a personal way about Jewishness, OCD, grief, autism, feminism, intersectionality, and parts of your life story. And I'm super excited to chat with you. Welcome.
Thank you. When you read it like that in a list, it sounds like no fun, doesn't it? But I assure you, there are moments of lightness.
Definitely lightness and, dare I say, humour as well. So, yes.
Definitely. My heart always sinks when I'm at a party with people. What do you write? Oh, nonfiction. Oh, what about? And I think, oh dear, how am I going to address this?
Maybe I should just say you write about life, so that that encompasses everything. So
yeah.
My first thought was around kinship. So in Letters to My Weird Sisters, I find you have a kinship with these sisters, your sisterhood, through these historical figures. And I was wondering, how did you arrive at this feeling of kinship? And does it vary with your different sisters and the knowledge that we have of them? I guess everything in history is our imagination about them anyway. There's some things that they may have written or some of it with that. But I was wondering about this feeling of kinship that you have with these historical figures, and what do you think about it now and how it's come about?
Well, it came about because I got my autism diagnosis relatively late in life at the age of 41. And from the beginning, I was thinking about how I'd never recognised myself until I'd read accounts by autistic women, the official ones written from outside in. I could never relate to. I always suspected, but I thought, but I'm not that person who's being described. I wouldn't describe myself like that. I don't think most other people would describe me like that either. And then when I found sort of early autobiographical writings by women like Donna Williams, I thought, oh, yes, there's something I recognise here. And I was thinking about this sense of loneliness, and I was thinking about how culturally, when you're in a marginalised group, you want to go back and claim people. So, for example, in my one novel, I wrote about Queen Anne. And sometimes she's talked about as a queer figure because of her relationships with women. And we don't really know what they were, but she's available as a figure for people to feel that kind of kinship with. Or to take a more recent example, Gentleman Jack, you know, and Lister, she's sort of reclaimed as a queer figure. And I was thinking, could I reclaim some weird people? And I chose the word weird because it's really not very good manners, sort of, academically or any other way, to actually diagnose someone after their death, or indeed diagnose someone at all. But I wanted to explore this kinship, and I wanted to provide the sense of community for other women, because I know how many of us, and people of marginalized genders, because I know how many of us have gone through life feeling like, you know, the only alien on the planet. And so I started to look for women, and a few I sort of didn't go with. So I didn't go with Hildegard of Bingen, and I didn't go with Marjorie Kemp, and I didn't go with some wonderful 17th century English Protestant nuns who left lots of autobiographies in Belgium. You know, I mean, they're fascinating, but I didn't go with them in the end. Very glad to have met them. And so in the end, I came to four, and I had a different sort of relationship with each of them. And I came up with the idea of addressing them as you, because then I could address the difference in this relationship, which is in the differences between me and them in culture or status or whatever, the differences between me and them in other ways, but also the similarities, and also to reflect the fact that some of them, one of them left a massive, massive historical print, and the others did not. So the one that left a massive historical legacy was, of course, Virginia Woolf, and I addressed her as Mrs. Woolf and signed myself as Joanne Lindbergh Doctor, because I had a feeling that to address her as Virginia would be presumptuous, for example. So I'm very, well, I hope I'm respectful to all of them, but I'm very aware that I am entering into the presence of with her. So that informs that better. And then second letter to Adelheid Bloch. She was a young woman who was murdered as part of the Nazi program of murdering intellectually disabled people or disabled people of any kind. And we have nothing of her voice. We have only a few records, a very sad record, let's say, and the words that condemned her to death, which were horrible words, idiot, life unworthy of life. And I was thinking about those two words and how we stand in the shadow of them and what they meant for her and what is the supposed link between them. So my letter to her is kind of exploring history, because there's not much of her to say. And also, I wanted to write that, the letter to her, to say, you are not left out. You are a sister too. And I apologize for all the times you have been left out. And then the third letter was to Frauvi. Now, Frauvi doesn't even have a name. Her only trace is as an anonymized mother of an anonymized patient in Hans Asperger's paper. And he describes her. He never says that she has what he thinks her son has. And yet he describes her as being remarkably similar. And when you read about her, that, for example, she wasn't that interested in how she dressed. She wasn't that interested in running the house. She had a tendency, when everything got too much for her, to go and walk in the mountains with a book and think, mm-hmm. And so in that essay, I'm expressing my kinship with her. I'm also a mother, though not of somebody who's been given an autism diagnosis. And so I'm thinking about autism and motherhood and how you can't really untangle autistic mothers like me from autism mothers. I thought I could try elaborately to untangle the two concepts, but they arrive in a sticky bunch. So I'm going to address the sticky bunch, which is what I do in that. So that's very much about motherhood. And then the last one was Johannes Kepler's mother, Katharina Kepler, who was accused of witchcraft in Germany, again in the early 17th century. And because her very brilliant and very conscientious son defended her and kept a record, we have a sense of this woman. And what she was a woman who just wouldn't be soft and wouldn't cry when she was supposed to cry and butted in when she had something to say, and is the sort of unsoftened woman that a lot of us on the spectrum are, unless we mask. So that was about unsoftened womanhood, its consequences and its uses. And then there was one last letter, which was to someone who actually was my friend, who died a few years ago, who had her autism diagnosis not long before she died.
One of the things I reflect now, and it'd be great to perhaps tackle the nuance and the complexity that you tackle with all of those figures, and maybe we can touch on one or two of the ones you'd like, is how you came to the letter form. And it's interesting, if I look and read back across all of your work, some of it's in poetry form, you have your memoir form, that the structure on that form seems just really right. Like you're addressing them sort of personally, and you're taking the moment of where we are now with our modern day sense of view of where we've got, but still, like you said, very respectful of who they might have been or how we are in the imagination. And in your writing, do you come to form kind of naturally because you're kind of getting the content, then it seems like this is a natural formal process? Or where does form and structure sit within your writing process? It just seems to really sit so well and amplify across so much of your work, but it's so varied, memoir, poetry, and this. And I didn't know if it's one of those intangible, organic things which just grows out, or whether there was something which kind of hit upon it.
It takes a while. The thing that makes what you're trying to do work takes a while. So for my memoir, Small Pieces, it took me a while to come on to that structure of 10 vessels from a Kabbalistic image, for example. And once I'd got that, it all became much easier. With Letters to My Weird Sisters, I was originally, it was Weird Sisters, and I was thinking about writing essays. And then I thought about a book I really loved by Georgina Klieg, who's a wonderful, wonderful writer. She is blind, and she wrote a book, wonderful book, about and addressed to Helen Keller, called Blind Rage. And it's a series of letters. And so she's coming from her point in the present, and she's partly writing a biography of Helen Keller, only in the second person. And she's sort of coming to some kind of reckoning with the figure that Helen Keller, who has been made to be, you know, the good disabled person, the inspirational disabled person. And I thought, yeah, that's how to do it. Partly because, you know, I wanted to sort of express this sense of intimacy that you can have with the people that we have in our heads for whatever reason, whether we've imagined them or some kind of reading has put in that sort of parasocial relationship, I guess. And also, particularly with Adelheid Bloch, who was mostly non-speaking, you know, who is, with respect to me, less privileged. I did not want to speak for her. So if I spoke to her, then I would not be, well, I wouldn't be appropriating her, which was my hope. But I'm very, very clear. I respect distance. When there's a me and you, you're respecting the distance between you. There's a relationship, but that relationship is a relationship of two different individuals.
That's really clear, really well thought out, and just really works as it does across all of your work, I find, that form and content. And perhaps tackling Virginia Woolf, because so famous to so many of us, and has, I guess, a myth associated with her. We all have in our heads probably what Virginia Woolf is to us. Mm. And obviously there's quite a few threads of mainstream sort of views about what she is or was to us. And you really tackle, I think, a lot of that nuance in the way that, you know, we being humans are going to have good bits and bad bits and complex bits. And, you know, you set that up all the way from the front, actually, in your letter to the readers, this complexity, this intersectionality, and this nuance. And I guess she did have so much public, you know, of her own writings. I guess the question would be, so when you were researching that and reading her writing, how did your view of her, or the view that we have in our head of her, change much? And what would you have said maybe is, in your reading of her, most misunderstood or most surprised you about what came out of your reading and your letter to her?
I think the unusual thing was that I came up with, I mean, there's so much Woolf scholarship. So this comes with a sort of caveat that somebody else may have said this. I looked as hard as I could, but there's so much. So apologies if you're out there. When I read her in her, these were unpublished during her lifetime, and they were written to be read to the other members of the Bloomsbury group. So they're quite intimate. When she wrote about her early life and her life as a teenager and her difficulties with clothes and appearance, I mean, she had difficulties with clothes and appearance throughout her life. And I think felt very left out. And there's a story she wrote that's a kind of supplement to the Mrs. Dalloway book, called The Dress, that is about somebody arriving at a party in a wrong dress and feeling, I think the phrase is, like a fly in a saucer. And it's on the face of it such a trivial thing. But this woman feels contaminated by wrongness and utterly rejected and then ejected by the society and this party, and it's all bound up with this dress. And there's a character of Mrs. Dalloway, and her Doris, that's right, Doris Kilman. Yeah, Miss Kilman, who is Mrs. Dalloway's daughter's tutor. And Wolfe has sometimes been criticised for writing about this woman in a very snobby, unkind way. But, you know, it's Clarissa Dalloway's snobbery and unkindness. And, you know, the assumption might be that Wolfe identifies with Dalloway, and to some extent, I suppose she does, but to some extent, you know, I've only written one novel, but you identify with all your characters. That's what animates them. But I realise that the sort of outsideness that she gives to Miss Kilman's own thoughts, this sort of pain of being looked at and being found ludicrous or disgusting, I realised that's her own experience. And this was sort of corroborated by other sources. There's this very touching passage in her husband's book where he said that people would often laugh at her in the street. And he didn't really know why, but people did. And there's a line in Jacob's Room that he says something like, it's not walls that kill us, it's the way people look and laugh and run up the steps of omnibuses, which resonates with me so much that I've used it so many times in so many different things. And so if anything new came out of it, it was perhaps that reading of Miss Kilman and the understanding that although Virginia Woolf was very much an insider, you know, well-connected, upper class, so on and so forth, she had that about her which always made her feel outside.
And I might pick up on your comment on clothes, because it's a theme in some of your other books as well. And I guess it's both a very modern day concern, but you can see throughout history how humans decide to dress is, at least in part, quite a complicated social and economic dance, a power dance, all of these things. And when we put our minds to it, it's obviously a thing which is important to us. We spend a lot of time doing so. But as you point out, Wolfe had trouble with it, and you write about it. And I it's kind of really interesting, that piece of kinship which comes out. And is that something which really resonated with you when you thought, oh, this is something I see, and I guess other people would resonate with it too?
Oh yes, so much. I mean, I think Wolfe, like me, she found clothes throughout her life both fascinating and excruciating. I mean, she knew that, you know, they're not really trivial. They're a matter of social life and death, aren't they? And yeah, my whole life, I've wanted to do something different with clothes. And sometimes got looked at askance when I did. And sometimes more and more I've used clothes to hide and blend in. And there's a scene she talks about in her life where she's her half-brother is dragging her out to society events. And she doesn't have a dress allowance that would allow her to dress for the life he thinks she should lead. So she thinks she's found a wonderful solution. It is very creative. She buys upholstery fabric, which is cheaper and different and has a dress made of it. And she's really pleased with it. And she comes downstairs for the pre-going out inspection he always subjected her to. And she went down, he looked her up and down and said, take that dress away and burn it. And she didn't, I'm glad to say. So it was both a humiliation and a defiance.
Yeah, it's really, that really comes across. Thinking about Bloch, one of the things which really came across, and you've mentioned it already, is this way that, and I guess there's a debate at the moment around advocacy and appropriation and, you know, how much can we speak for one another? And when you kind of think about it to the extreme, in some ways, we can't speak for anyone else. We're never in anyone's mind, you know, even the people closest to you. We don't really understand consciousness that well about how it works. So on the one hand, it's kind of obvious that one can't really speak for another truly. on the other hand, we know that we care for one another and often want the best or want to try and do things. And it was just really notable to me, that sort of nuance, you know, for someone who doesn't have, you know, a body of work, you know, might not be that verbal in that exchange. And I guess it's the same question. What did you find out, you know, in researching that, or in your letter? Was there anything surprising, or maybe not surprising, or misunderstood, or how you kind of felt in trying to write that letter?
Yeah, I think I learned, when I think about it, the first thing that comes into my head was, I never want to use the words moron, imbecile, or idiot again. Because I hadn't realised how that words had been used to throw people out of society, to throw people out of safety, and actually to kill them, that they are, you know, to use a big word, necropolitical concepts. And that it was very important, that it was a matter of great importance that I write this letter to Adelheid, and that people see that she's human, and that people see that she's not totally different from me, because there's an issue in sort of discourse around autism, as I'm sure you know, that there's a difference between high functioning and low functioning. And so there's constant sort of stress between splitters and lumpers, as there is with any classification. We can't possibly be the same thing, or we all are the same thing. And also, I tend to lump, not because I particularly want to get all the attention that people imagine comes from being severely afflicted. It doesn't. I think actually what you get from being seen to be severely afflicted is ignored and pushed aside, not massive amounts of attention. But because I think it's safer if we hang on to them. You know, if you can't have solidarity with someone as opposed to pity or care, they're not safe, because they're outside identification. So I very much felt that it was a political act writing to her, and she did speak to the bits of me who know what it's like to be dehumanized, actually.
Yeah, I had an earlier conversation last year with Stephen Unwin, and he makes similar points. His son doesn't have very many words at all. He occasionally has a cup of tea, and there is this, you know, this idea about what it means to be human. And if, you know, there's one school of thought which goes, well, to be human is to have language. Well, saying that, what are you saying about all of these other humans? And it's something that we come to. In your next couple of letters, the theme on motherhood comes out in a really complex way, and I'm really interested in that, because actually it's a theme which has picked up also in your other books and essays. But this is kind of also seen through often the writings of someone else and a man, I guess, with that. But I guess it's the same things. Did it make you think differently or emphasize on some of your own thinking around motherhood? Or was there anything surprising or misunderstood around that came through in those letters?
I think what I realized in those letters from reading Tanner's papers and Asperger's papers was, and stuff by Bruno Bettelheim as well, was how it seemed glaringly obvious to me that these so-called refrigerator mothers were neurodivergent, and that their neurodivergent presentation was being horribly and unkindly and disastrously misread. And I think I hadn't been quite prepared until I came across Frowby and came across these other women, how sure I would feel about that. That these autism mothers, yes, I'm sure there are mothers of autistic people who are not themselves autistic, but the women being so described in these papers were, and that the misreading of their neurodivergent presentation had led to a horrible, horrible wrong direction in the way autism was seen and the way it was addressed.
Yeah, I could really see that. And I still sort of astonished how much damage that concept still has today, really.
Yes.
And particularly in some geographies, it seems to be still a really dominant trope around that. And I'm kind of really surprised at myself in some ways that I've been so slow or late to learn around, you know, like for instance, this concept of matrescence, also menopause, that so many biological, psychological, neuroscience-based changes happen to us, like we have at puberty and those which are sort of well understood, but they're not taught about. The science has only just started to come through, and just seems a real hole, a real lacuna in that thinking. And maybe thinking about your memoir, you know, you talk a lot about that, you know, what motherhood has meant to you and all of those type of things. And I guess one of my reflections is that we kind of need more education and lived experience around it. I guess maybe that's the same sort of question. Is there anything that around this area that you think is just people should understand more about motherhood, or is like really misunderstood? And I guess this intersection, because it goes with all of these things with identity and autism and all of these things, you just have this really complicated strand of things on what motherhood means, and it's come into your letters and to your work.
Yeah, I think what came through in the writing of this letter and what I was reading for it was how we still, on some very fundamental level, we have trouble seeing mothers as human beings, as individuals. We're seen in terms of what we provide, you know, and the traffic all goes one way. So it's partly about relationships of care and how we see them as non-reciprocal. And it's partly about the way I think it's probably really developmentally appropriate for a small child to have no empathy for their mother, because, you know, they've got enough to deal with. They've got all this pruning or not pruning if you're autistic going on. They're trying to deal with suddenly arriving in this body and this environment. I think it must be overwhelming being a baby. So the mum is probably presumably their maternal holding environment. So while she's being their maternal holding environment, she's also rather inconveniently a person with her own needs and her own limitations and her own desires. But we seem to take this sort of baby unawareness of personhood through our whole lives towards anyone on which we're dependent. We're kind of, we don't see it. We don't see it. So, you know, and you saw this during the pandemic, where suddenly people became aware of how these people that we don't see, delivery people, people who work in supermarkets, people who work in hospitals, all these service industry, quote unquote, service providers, were terribly, terribly important.
Mm.
And you kind of hoped, I mean, I wrote the book in the middle of the pandemic, and I thought, well, maybe this will be a new acceptance that people who care for us need care and appreciation. But it seems to have just fallen back again.
Yeah, we had this idea that we might build back better, is what I heard in several types of industry. And actually, we had it in theatre as well. And like you, my observation is that we haven't really fundamentally shifted that much. And what exactly you say is true, like all of the caring, the unpaid caring, and then you go up a little, the really badly paid caring of cleaning, nursing, teaching, all of these tends to be, not exclusively, but tends to be intersectional with womanhood and all of this. And you're right, it's throughout history been completely ignored, and now is just mostly ignored, and it seems kind of really surprising. And when it kind of comes to the fore, like it has done, it has a kind of moment in its spotlight, and then seems to have gone back to being ignored. Maybe riffing on that, one of the other things I get more from your memoir writing was a huge a lot of writing around sort of therapy and discussion ideas. And another one, which I kind of view in the same bucket, are these conversations you have with a rabbi. And I guess I had a conversation with a priest earlier this year, and a lot of those conversations people put in the kind of therapy bucket, in the sense that we're talking about meaningful things with people. I'm interested to know perhaps your view of all the different sorts of therapy you've had and conversations with rabbis. What's been helpful, what maybe you think is maybe less helpful, and why you've kind of it seems to me that your writing, or writing it out, particularly in your forms, in some ways I think maybe writers always have it as a form of therapy, is maybe why a lot of us write anyway, to try and process ideas that we're having. But yeah, any thinking around your conversations with the rabbi, or therapy, or kind of writing as therapy as it is in your work?
Well, I suppose you're looking for connection, you're looking to be heard, and you're looking to hear yourself better. And I think the first thing that comes into my mind when people say, oh, you've had a lot of therapy, is like, I feel this very British guilt and shame and embarrassment about that. You know, for not managing to just pull my socks up and get on with it, and also for having the privilege to pay for it. I mean, the truth is everyone should be able to have access to it. It shouldn't be a luxury. And also, I think working, you know, you work on yourself partly for the benefit of the people around you, so that you can relate better to them and be of more use to them and listen to them better with less noise in your head. Well, if I think of things that I wouldn't want to do again, I think seeing a very strict Freudian psychoanalyst was a bit much. And I have very mixed feelings about cognitive behaviour therapy. I did find that for some of my OCD and my anxieties, just dealing with it behaviourally did help, because it is a loop from, you know, feeling to anxious sensations, to thoughts, to actions, all the way around. But I've never found it particularly helpful for depression, because I don't think the idea that things are very sad, or things are very difficult, or things are very painful, is actually a cognitive error.
Yeah. What's the phrase? It's a feature, not a bug.
A feature, not a bug. Exactly. And also, CBT is very quick and very short, and I think it's quite shallow. You deal with this quite, it's done in quite restricted language, in a restricted time space, in a very set way. And the idea is that anyone can deliver it. And actually, I think no one person can deliver therapy to any one person, other person. It's not about the system, it's about the relationship always. So I think it misunderstands that. And also, I think the reason why it's everywhere is because it's quantifiable, and therefore costable. And you can give someone a questionnaire at the beginning, give them a questionnaire at the end, and say, look, there's an outcome.
Yeah. 2.4. Isn't that great?
Exactly. I'm 2.4 less hopeless than I was when I filled in Beck's hopelessness scale at the beginning of this.
Yeah.
But also, you know, that's, you know, failing to take into account the fact that, you know, because you've sunk the cost into it, and because, you know, you don't want to be horrible to the nice psychologist, of course you're going to say you feel better.
Yeah. And in that sense, the conversations with the rabbis, because there was at least a form of shared culture with some, because actually, again, I think your emphasis on the individual is exactly right. Some rabbis you'll have a connection with, and some you'll not, even if you've had a shared understanding of certain aspects of culture. Because of that, I guess in some ways, perhaps more helpful, or at least more thought-provoking in some of that, or less so, because they also come from a particular place and reading of that.
Well, I suppose the two rabbis I speak to in the book are far more orthodox than I am. So again, I was aware of that difference, and you know, the way they talk to other Jews is to be respectful of that difference themselves. And rabbis are not priests; they don't have any closer connection to God than the rest of us. What they have is deeper knowledge of the scripture. So it's as if you ask them, you're saying, well, what does, you know, collective Jewish wisdom think about this? And they can tell you, or they can tell you their interpretation. So it's not quite like therapy in that way. I mean, they can, you know, they could be emotionally intelligent or not as anyone else. They can help, you know, contain whatever anxiety you have. But it's like knocking on a door and going, what does the book say?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think you have to understand that for a Jew, that's not a dry relationship. The book is very living thing that connects us all, the word.
Yes. Well, actually, that's a good segue to one thought I had, which is how well you rate the so-called DSM. I think we're on to DSM-5 now, which stands yes. for, let me get this right. So it's an American psychological or psychiatric manual. So it's called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM. And we're now on 5, and we were on DSM-4, and there's been DSM-1, 2, and 3, which I guess intersects with labels and the
DSM,
like.
DSM, The Empire Strikes Back, all of that.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I guess if you're practicing psychiatrists, obviously it's going to be somewhat helpful. But I guess for you know, a lot of people in the field and this complexity, it's kind of not helpful, or the way we've thought about a lot of these things, you know, changes with time, and we can actually see it within the manual, which is kind of interesting. And I remember someone commenting to me that some of the you know, human conditions we see now, you know, maybe a couple of hundred years ago, people would have been thought of as mystics, or you know, treated very differently, and now we might give a label as schizophrenic or something else. And so it seems to me that a lot of these things have been very well preserved in humanity over time, over thousands of years, and the way that we thought about them has changed over time. And you write about DSM a little bit in labels, so I was thinking about, you know, what are your thoughts about the manual now? How's it changed? Is it helpful in and labeling when we have all of this complexity, and how maybe there's something about the human brain today where we seem to want to bucket and label a lot, and to the extent that it's useful or not.
Well, when I first heard of the DSM, I was in my late teens, early 20s, and Jonathan Miller was talking about it. And of course, he was trained as a neurologist, I think. And of course, I very much looked up to him, admired him. I wanted to be someone like that, you know, this wonderful public intellectual, also Jewish, knows everything or can give the impression of knowing everything. Oh, the opera and the science. Wow. Wow. And so it was aspirational to me. And I liked the idea in those days of, you know, big compendia of things. So when I was a small child, we had a Pears cyclopedia, which is that big, but I was very much liked the idea. In probably a rather autistic way, that I could know all the things and all the, and I think I talk about this in connection with Linnaeus in the book. It's a particularly autistic kind of cognitive talent and cognitive joy to be able to arrange things in patterns. It's aesthetically and it's functionally pleasing, and I liked the idea that I could know things and know other people, and I didn't think about difference between classifying a flower and classifying a person. And when I came to research my book about OCD, or possibly even before then, I began to read all the pushback against it. And I understood that it's the outcome of a lot of very specific political and economic interests and cultural interests compromising with each other. So it's necessary in America, because in order to get health insurance, you have to tick a box. So you have to have a label, no label, no treatment. And then you've got the psychiatrist on one side, you've got other professional groups, you've got the drug companies, you've got the health companies, you've got increasingly patient groups. So it's pressure for patients, for example, that brought in PTSD. And it was pressure from people that had homosexuality removed from the book. And most recently, there has been some pressure back and forth between autistic people and professionals who deal with us. And I think I see it for what it is. It's a sort of pragmatic fudge. And if you take it as literally true, it could do a lot of harm.
Yeah.
And also that, you know, I always talk to my students about this when we do ethics, the difference between savoir and connaître. Unfortunately, we don't have the equivalence. You know, savoir, I know this is a cup, you know, glass rather. We obviously don't know it's a glass. I don't expect any reciprocity with it. I pick it up and I use it. Whereas, you know, to say I know Benjamin, I'm talking about reciprocal relationship, in Martin Buber's sense, I and thou. And that is a qualitatively different form of knowing from knowing a person as a collection of facts.
Yeah.
And I don't think actually that any, that it's ever appropriate or safe to claim to know a human being, except in the connectra sense. I mean, obviously, if they're lying down on the table anaesthetized and you're, you know, dissecting their colon or something, then you savoir their body. But once they're awake and you're talking to them, it has to be connectra.
Yes, you don't. You'll never savoir their soul.
No, exactly, yes. Exactly. Yeah. Let alone classify it.
Yes, and I think the Greeks had similar different words, and we seem to fail it in English. And I think that's really practical insight that, sure, we've got the system as it is, bureaucratic, economic, and the like, and some of the bureaucracy requires tick box and economic interest to do that, but don't be fooled into thinking that's it. And in some ways, referring to our earlier comment, you know, if you're reading the scripture, you know, if you take it literally, you're just only going to see one surface element, which will probably steer you wrong with a lot of that. Thinking about your memoir, you wrote towards the end of it three kind of quite contradictory, laughable life rules within them. But I think I see a touch of it myself and in others, although you write it very clearly and quite contradictory. So one of them was, my writing should be successful or I'm a failure, but if I write for money, I will have no integrity. Another one was, I should be my best to stay thin while bearing in mind that only trivial-minded women think about these things. And your last one was, I should be a perfect and ever-attentive mother to my son without becoming the kind of reactionary betrayer of the sisterhood who allows her husband to support her. And, you know, I laughed at that, and we laugh at that now, but I actually think there, you know, you might, you've obviously had it in your mind to an extreme, but I think we all have these conflicts, you know, wherever we sit. And you just wrote about them kind of very, very plainly, and obviously they sat in your mind. You know, and so one is about, you know, money and work, and another is about, you know, how we look or how we don't look in society, and another, and one is about patriarchy, motherhood, sisterhood, and you know, family, and all of that. I was really interested in that. And what do you think about hearing them now, and your reactions to writing or looks and the like?
Oh gosh, is that The Woman Who Thought Too Much?
Yeah.
Oh, because it's such a long time since I wrote that. Now. I thought, oh, did I write that?
Yeah, did I?
That was my first response. It makes me think about how I think we're all in these pincers. I'm describing kind of pincers, aren't they? Don't, from this side and from that side. Don't be that, but don't be this. You absolutely cannot win. And I think it's, I'm sure there are things that apply to everyone, but it's certainly true to women. For women, like don't be a boring mother, don't be a heartless career woman, don't be sexy, that's immoral, don't be unsexy, what's the point of you then? And yeah, I think it's objectively the case for a given measure of objectivity that we are caught in that, so in in those social concerns. But I think also, if you're autistic or if you have OCD or both, one thing that can happen is that you take these very much to heart. And I'm still not entirely on top of all the ways in which I do that. I think that's what's meant by black and white thinking. So these things can become very destructive parasites inside you.
Yeah, I think that's very wise. We have these things. I think a bit sometimes it's the stress which comes at, for instance, family dinners, particularly like at festive occasions, because we have to wear these hats and they all land on our head at the same time. So suddenly you are a mother, a wife, a sister, and maybe a daughter, all at the same time. And typically we try and separate those hats out, and then we realize that obviously we are all of these things, but if we're all of these things at the same time, that's where there's some of the stresses come from. And it's kind of very obvious when you have these kind of family gatherings and suddenly your own mother expects you to be a daughter, but if you're being a daughter, how are you being a mother, and all of these type of things. But it's clear to me that actually those similar conflicts are around everything, and now we have it today where we say to women or young women, oh, you've got to speak up, but also you've got to sit and be quiet in the corner, and all of these things simultaneously.
Speak up, but not in a way that makes your face or your voice seem ugly while you're doing it.
Yeah, exactly. Speak up, but only the things I want to hear.
Be feisty, but only in a sexy way.
Yeah. Exactly. I wanted to touch on one of your other books, which I was really moved by, which is essentially, I guess if I have to sum it up, was is kind of on grief, but also the limits to what we can either understand about another person or what we go through and how we process grief. And I guess for those of us who've been through these kind of events or traumas, it always lives with us in some way. And I think perhaps it's meant to, right? With some of that. But maybe looking back, what did you maybe most appreciate around writing that book, and what it maybe helped you or revealed about the way you think about the world or yourself? Or was it that, in the end you kind of thought, well, in some ways, one of my conclusions is that we can never quite understand, and maybe that needs to be enough. But I don't know what you think about grief.
Well, I very deliberately left the book open. I mean, there are different kinds of grief. I mean, my parents both died of natural causes, and I don't feel the acute grief for them that I felt at the time. But my brother, and this is sort of what set the book in motion, took his own life, unfortunately. And it still, cuts like a knife. And there could be a number of reasons for that. I don't know, but it's still, very much present and painful. And I can hear as I'm talking now that I find it more hard to talk about than I realised. But I think you go through stages, it goes and it comes back. So just for one illustration of that, there's the subtitle of Small Pieces is A Book of Lamentation. And I make reference to the Book of Lamentations again, which is a book supposedly written by Jeremiah, but actually written by various other hands, lamenting the fall of Jerusalem, the fall of the temple and the Babylonian exile. And I'm now writing, under the auspices, if you like, of Lamentations again, which very much suggests things unfinished. But I think I wanted to write, how can I put it? When I started writing the book, I was thinking about reparations in the sort of object relation sense, how art makes reparations, how it can make reparations towards yourself, towards your internal objects, which are your internal representations of your people, the people close to you. And yeah, I still felt like that afterwards. But also, I very much took with me something my supervisor, Meg Jensen, said to me, which he said, you may want to do something really different. You may want to do something about trauma or whatever. But in the end, all you can do in the face of this is try and make something beautiful. So in the course of that book, I tried to make something beautiful. And it is a kind of monument, and it doesn't stop anything being sad. But there it is.
Wow, that's a really beautiful insight. Yeah, just dwelling on that a moment. Yeah, it doesn't take away from its sadness, but you can build something insightful or beautiful from it. In your writing, then, are you conscious of what tradition you might be writing in? Because I guess at the moment there is a potentially, you could say, a mini flourishing of life writing, which, you know, particularly if you go back 200 years ago, you know, because of the historical and all the other circumstances we've been alluding to, very little life writing from women or any other marginalized type.
Well, very
of
little public group. Life writing.
Public life writing.
And there were diaries. And, yeah.
Yeah, that got published, went into the machine, or, you know, all that is then read today by some more mass audience, sits in libraries. And the like. And I think I actually think we might be in a golden age of this kind of life writing, but partially just because we have it now in a way and in a publicly accessible way. And before, I actually think the same on so-called children's writing, which I think is actually just writing for everyone, that again, that's potentially we've got a flourishing within that. And you're very well read, and your books, you know, well researched, and obviously chime in all of that. And I guess writing in the moment is harder to place. But do you feel you're writing in a tradition? Do you have a kind of sisterhood and kinship with these other writers writing alongside you, all from life, even though you've got all of these different things? Or does it feel a little bit more of a lonely furrow still?
Oh,
that
gosh.
You know, there's this writers, you write in your room, you know, writers may meet up a little bit, but it's still a more lonely kind of occupation. So yeah, kinship with others. And is it a golden age of life writing at the moment, and how should we think about that?
I think it is. I mean, I'm very much don't deal with people who lament that so many people are doing it now. I think it's brilliant that so many people are doing it now. And we're hearing all these stories and hearing all these voices, and it's not that any of them are definitive. The whole point is nothing is definitive. We have this mosaic, these overlapping images, and then from these different sort of subjective viewpoints, we might get somewhere near the whole, but the whole isn't actually possible. Well, you do feel on your own, but you also feel that you have other people behind you. I mean, we have influences. Like, I have two very different ones. For example, one is Marion Milner, who was a psychoanalyst who wrote in the 1920s a book called A Life of One's Own, which is an act of introspection. And I read that in my early 20s, and that was very influential. And another one is an American writer called Betty McDonald, who wrote very funny memoirs. Very funny, very sharp memoirs. She's best known for The Egg and I, but my favourite book is a book by her called The Plague and I. And it is literally a hilarious account of a stay in a TB sanatorium in Depression, Seattle.
Wow.
Yeah. And she's just there in all her spikiness.
Yeah.
And
that's
it's great.
Amazing. So you teach as well. Is this the teaching help your writing, and how much do you enjoy that? And is there anything perhaps people would find or a teaching technique which is maybe unusual, or something that you've come across that you think, okay, this is actually really good for my students to think about, which maybe you haven't discovered more? So yeah, what do you think about teaching, and do you have any teaching techniques or even books or things that you nudge students towards, which perhaps is a little bit more unusual or underrated?
Oh, well, I go back and forth a lot between my work and teaching. Students can teach you something, or quite often putting the teaching materials together is a good way to realize what you think about something. Because often you don't, you just have an intonation of what you think about it, and a sense of I want to go there, but I don't want to go there. And that joins up with that as the kind of pre-verbal intonation. And then you have to put it into words and say, oh, so that's what I think. So it's useful in that way. And sometimes students can point out biases or tendencies or habits that you wouldn't be able to see for yourself, which is useful, difficult, but useful. What I've found as I've become a more experienced teacher is I try and do less and less. You know, I know I have to provide some content and that they need content, but the more confident you get, the more confident I get, the less I am about giving something from me to them, you know, the banking idea of education, especially as it's a skill, and the more I am about facilitating. So the thing I always recommend, and she's not exactly underrated, is Natalie Goldberg, Writing Down the Bones or Writer's Mind, because she says, get to know your mind. Believe me, for writing, it's all you have. And in a sense, that's the only thing you need to know. But it's a very complex and profound thing, and something that you keep re-encountering.
That's great. Yes. So I have read that. So there's emphasis on just, you know, doing less and enabling others. That's kind of quite profound in its own way. Perhaps that's
it's
a good segue.
It's hard to get out of the way.
Yes.
Hard to do.
And actually, probably as you mentioned earlier, a little bit like in therapy, probably a lot of it is in the dynamics of the people, both student to student, as well as student to teacher, whether that comes alive or not for all of the various reasons.
Yeah, and it's restraining yourself. Listening is such a hard thing to do because it's actually about restraining yourself.
Yeah.
So much.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. This whole called, what's the consultant term? Active listening, which is a slight oxymoron within it, but there is a truth to it that actually it's quite hard. You have to put effort into it. But it is definitely on the restraining side as well as the.
And it's the same with being a parent, actually, especially as they get older, you know, restraining yourself.
Yeah. Letting them be. Yeah, I'm not sure how well I'm doing on that. We'll see.
I'm not sure how well any of us are doing. My son's 20 now, and I said, oh, well, I wasn't going to talk about it because I knew you were going to mention it yourself. But he said, that's never stopped you before.
Yeah, harsh, isn't it? And
it's,
I was reading a short essay you had in a collection recently, and he was making some commentary on a questionnaire you have to send in. And, you know, his commentary was basically saying, yeah, well, my mum does too much of this rather than the.
Yeah, he gave me a bit of a consumer report.
Yeah. Well, that might be a good segue into the last kind of couple of questions. And one is sort of about your own writing process. And maybe if there's anything you want to share about that, about how you approach writing. And I guess I've spoken to now a variety of creators, and there is definitively no one way of doing it. And in some ways, the advice is not that helpful because it's always specific to the person. But I'm still intrigued because of just that sheer variety. So I suppose, you know, how would you describe your writing process or writing day? Is there anything about it that you think is kind of, oh, this is kind of quirky, but it works for me? Do you prefer writing in the morning and the evening? Are you writing in long bursts, short bursts, everything? Do you still write in notebooks, or do you prefer typing? Do you like doing lots of research and then some, or maybe you have a little bit and you work from a sentence and an idea? I think we touched on the fact that structure and form sometimes happens somewhere in the early middle and then is often a linchpin for how things go, but it's not often there at the very start of where you're going. But yeah, anything you'd like to comment on about how you write or how you think about writing?
Oh gosh, well, I've just learned again to listen and be patient, because I have had this image in my head of when I want to write, but I've just shouted down the well and I'm waiting for an echo. I know it's working when I hear an echo and something's coming up that I didn't expect, when I call it meeting myself coming back. And you can sort of create the conditions for that to happen by sitting down and writing, but you can't will it to happen. And also, I think it's just very important to get that self-consciousness out the way earlier, and I'm not good at that. You know, all those voices around your head telling you should do this or you should do that, you know, those pincer voices we talked about earlier, watch out for them. They're there. They may be there in heavy disguise, but they'll be there, and you want to firmly shut them out of the room. or at least tell them to shut up, or come to some arrangement with them when you're writing, or they will just eat you and eat your writing.
Yes. I hear some writers sometimes use forms of either automatic writing techniques or just techniques where just the goal is to do the writing and trying not to listen to anything else. Do you find those helpful at all? Or
not as such, but I'll tell you what's helped with me, and that's moving from a pen to a keyboard.
Interesting.
Because I can touch type, but I've realized, you know, sort of post my autism diagnosis, I have elements of dyspraxia. One of them is I have never in my life been able to hold a pen properly. And I pinch very hard and it becomes very painful. And my writing is awful. And it lags behind my thought speed. Whereas if I type on a computer, on a keyboard, I can just straight out like that. And also there's something about the rhythmic tapping of the keys that seems to drum something up. So it's not, you know, removed from the physical process for me. It brings me into the physical process.
Interesting.
My fingers know how to write.
Yeah, I've heard that a couple of times now, because people often assume it's notebook and handwriting, which is somehow more true and authentic. And I think it really does depend the speed of your thought and how it happens. And you're exactly right. The physicality of it can actually get in the way. It needs to match how you're feeling and working. That's really interesting. Okay, great. I had one more referring back to letters to my weird sisters, because we only touched on her a little bit briefly, and it's your kind of, I think it's a postscript or an epilogue letter, but in some ways I feel it's a really important one. So I just wanted to touch on it, which was to Karen Freeborn, who was a part sort of inspiration on it. And I was interested, whether you wanted to comment on what you learned writing that letter and what that letter meant to you or means to you.
Oh, so much, because, you know, I miss Karen, so do so many other people. And she didn't publish as much as she might have done. I think two novels and one book of poetry in her lifetime, but there's more sitting around, really good stuff, which I'd like to put out there. So I partly put her in a book that I wanted, you know, say her name. But also, she was so much a part of my writing. And I think I've had difficulty in the past few years, and I don't mind mentioning it's because of the loss of her, because she was my receiver. Everyone needs something to receive that they're writing, and she was the person whose judgment I trusted. So when she looked at one book, one chapter, and said, "Well, it's good, but stop being apologizing."
Yeah.
I thought, well, Karen's told me to stop fucking apologizing, so I will. And when I sent her the mother chapter, and she said, "Excuse the F word again, that is fuck off good," I thought, that's real praise. Because, you know, she never let them take the Basildon out of the girl.
Yeah, I really sense that. And it's such a all of those letters together, I learned so much, and it was just sort of such a complete picture of just the complexity of where we are and what we've over history and some of our challenges and the like. Great. So the last couple of questions is, what are you working on? Are there any projects or items we should be aware of? Obviously, Letters to My Weird Sisters have gone into reprint, which is great. But yeah, anything you'd want to highlight in terms of what you're working on at the moment?
Oh, well, there's a possible book of essays that may or may not happen. That's depending on various things. But at the moment, I'm working on, again, it's something inspired by the Book of Lamentations. And it's maybe poetry, it may be lyric essays, or it may be hybrid. Hybrid's such a useful word. What is it? Oh, it's hybrid. And I'm using found materials, and I'm using acrostics, and I'm working in ways that disrupt my voice. And I'm really enjoying that.
Oh, that sounds exciting. I guess from this, so more early on, do you know whether something's going to be more poetic, short form, compressed, or longer form? Is that something which happens potentially earlier, or it just kind of depends on
poems arrive differently from longer form things?
Yeah,
poems often arrive as phrases.
Interesting.
Whereas longer things arrive for me as a sort of intimation of a shape.
And in your poetry, it's phrases more than images, or is it images with the phrases?
It's very, I think that's interesting. I haven't thought about that. I think with the poetry, I mean, I often use imagery in poetry. So it could be, I think, oh, that thing could be described as that sort of thing. Or I get a phrase, or I get both at once. Can't give a more definitive answer.
No, that's, I mean, that's fair. The other thing about your poetry, which I've read, is there's a musicality to it as well, a sound. I'm not sure if do you hear your poetry as well like that, or is it because it's just embedded in your lovely words and visuals, and also the way the lines break and everything? It's such a complex whole, but there's definitely something, although I've actually not read it out aloud, when I read it I hear it.
Well,
Sometimes that's more purposeful, it just falls out.
I think it goes, it just goes to the way I relate to language, which is quite autistic in some ways. I relate to it as a what Freud would call a thing presentation. I just like the stuff of it as well as the meaning of it. And my first word was cockle because of Mary, Mary, quite contrary, because my parents would read nursery rhymes to me. And
Wow.
Mary, Mary, quite contrary, how'd your garden grow with silver bells and cockle shells? So for me, speech and rhyme and that kind of musicality of language, I guess it all arrived in a lump.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. Do you think there's anything which is particularly misunderstood about your body of work that sort of people get it and they think, oh, it's just all about this? And you go, oh, no, you've not really done that. Or do you think it's slowly, people are kind of understanding where all of this is coming from?
I'm realizing it's more and more about form and how much I like form for form's sake, but not just you can make something beautiful, because it's become more and more about how we talk about things and the way in which we talk about things, the registers, the imagery, obscure things or bring things forward, and to some extent, how the way we talk about the world constructs the world. And is it possible as a writer to intervene in that or to reveal that?
Fascinating. And I guess, is that kind of line of thought slightly influenced by all of your studies in philosophy as well, or has it come a kind of a parallel aspect?
Oh, definitely. Philosophy and reading critical theory and sort of activism as well.
Yeah. Great. Well, on that note, do you have any advice, life advice, writing
Oh,
advice, or
blimey.
just life thoughts that you'd want to share? We haven't touched on that activism part that much, so maybe we could touch on, if you wanted to touch on that, you can, before thinking about advice to listeners. But yeah, anything you'd want to share?
Oh gosh, I don't know if I have much advice except I'm always telling people to be compassionate to themselves and other people, which is very annoying of me, but I do mean
I think that's very
it.
fair. Be kind is, I think, very good advice. So great. Well, on that note, I'd say please do read Joanne's books. They are excellent. And thank you very much for chatting with me.
And thank you very much for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Great.
Thank you.